Hello, I'm here with David Charles Rowan in the sacred landscape of Avebury in Stonehenge. David is an author, he's an astrologer, he's a neuro-holistic therapist, poet, musician, and a Stonehenge and Avebury tour guide, which encompasses astronomy, ancient history, archaeology, and Neolithic culture. We're here today to discover 10 things that you may not know about Stonehenge.
Right. Yes. Well, Stonehenge didn't just become created in the way, the form that we see it now. It developed over 1,500 years. So you can almost think of it as Stonehenge in five discrete stages, or three primary kind of main stages. So Stonehenge 1 didn't have any stones. Well, it had four. There was a bank and ditch, and these four stones in corners, and there were some holes, which were discovered by an astrologer called John Aubrey in the 17th century. And so they're now called the Aubrey Holes. So Stonehenge 1 could be used to measure seasons, and it could also be used to measure eclipses, predict eclipses as well. And that's a profound thing, because we are used to navigating space. We make a space for someone coming through a doorway. We watch our car in a car park. We're used to kind of being spatially conscious, but we're not necessarily used to being time conscious. So what we're doing and what we wear will obviously depend on the context of the season that we're in. You know, you don't wear shorts in the winter. You wouldn't wear a thick overcoat on the beach.
Absolutely.
And so being able to grasp a handle on time was absolutely vital for our ancestors. You know, when we came down from the canopy and we go out across savannic plains, we're open to predation, and we've got very ineffective claws and teeth, and we can't outrun a pussycat. So we develop these frontal lobes so we can anticipate what a predator's going to do. So we've got wired within our evolution this ability to think ahead many steps. So if you notice that when the trees go orange, certain birds disappear, the fish suddenly vanish, other creatures, other birds come into the environment, you know, you kind of, and the ground goes hard. And then the next day the ground is hard. And then the next day the ground is hard. And then the next day the ground is hard. If you don't know how long that's going to last, you don't know if your food store is going to kind of eke out. Can you eat it all now because the ground would go warm tomorrow? Or do you have to have just a tiny grain of rice every day? Because otherwise you're going to run out of food. So the ability to be able to predict accurately when a season's going to change begins to give you a handle on life. And so what we know is that Stonehenge and Avebury both had calendrical devices contained within them.
That is really, really fascinating. Really fascinating, fascinating ideas. And is there anything else you'd like to share about this?
Yeah, well, so then if Stonehenge 1 could be used to predict seasons, and if Stonehenge 2 you know, could be used in such a way, then what were all those big rocks for 1,500 years later? So Avebury is a kind of a microcosm of some of that in a way.
Yes.
There is there's a stone in Avebury that famous can be used to measure lunar eclipses. There's also another section of Avebury that can be used as a seasonal kind of sundial, so it uses shadow lines, you know. So when the sun comes up over the bank of the horizon, it hits a tall stone and it casts a shadow line out in front of it, and it touches or hits certain stones that are marked out in a funny shape. A lot of people think it's a circle, but it isn't. It's a strange, peculiar shape. And there's a dowser called Maria Wheatley who published it in a book in about 2006. So there was a smaller bank and ditch in Avebury that was kind of more fully enclosed. So what you see now of Avebury has been done by a different culture that came in. So the Neolithic people, or if you like, that built Avebury 1, their ideas of culture were communal. So they built long barrows, these places where you can actually go inside a burial tomb. There's one just over the hill there. And in fact, it's the only one you can go inside.
Because it's very linked, isn't it, the Stonehenge and Avebury, because because there's this 20-mile radius, isn't there, of the sacred landscape. So the relationship between Stonehenge and Avebury is very linked. And am I right in thinking that Stonehenge is the more solar type of... Penge, as opposed to Avebury, or
if you think of mundane astrology, mundane doesn't astrology doesn't mean boring astrology.
No, of course it doesn't. No. It comes from the French. It's anything but boring,
It comes from the French word "mundi," which means the world soul. So it's the So it's the astrology of Gaia, if you like. So in that type of astrology, the sun represents the monarch or the king or the power, and the moon represents the people.
Yes.
And so at Stonehenge, comfortably, you could get a good few people in there, maybe 100 or 200, 300. But at Avebury, you could get more than 1,000 people in there. So from that perspective...
It's much bigger, but Stonehenge... Yeah,
so you could think of Stonehenge as for the select few, if you like.
It's for the select few.
And you could think of Avebury as for the people.
Interesting... That's more like for the kind of kings and queens, is it?
Not necessarily. There's a funny thing about them, and that is that if you go to Avebury during the day, you can see it. You can see the shape, you can see the stones, you can see the temple, you know, really clearly. But as the sun sets in Avebury, it loses itself. You can't see the shape anymore. You kind of trip over a sheep and bang your nose in a stone, right? If you go to Stonehenge in daylight, it looks like a pile of rubble in a kind of a big open flat plain. But when you're in there at night, it changes. The shadows become longer, the stones loom, and you can, because you're not using your conscious mind or your optic eyes that much anymore, your senses open, you can feel the power of it. So the Temple of the Sun is best viewed at night, and the Temple of the Moon is best viewed in daylight.
So it's a sacred marriage, again, between the sun and the moon, and the cycles of that, which seems to be this kind of intertwining between the two in a very kind of circular way within the sacred landscape. Yeah.
Now, and you know that archaeological digs take a long time when people find new findings or they come up with a new theory. The amount of stuff that comes out of an archaeological dig has to be kind of sifted through, worked through, and then kind of pieced into some kind of narrative. So it takes a long time from the digging on the ground to when something comes out in book form. And there was a major dig in the Stonehenge landscape between 2003 and 2009 called the Riverside Project. So it's a multi-university kind of project run by a guy called Professor Mike Parker Pearson. And I've found over the years that archaeologists like sharing their information, you know, because, I don't know, maybe they don't get listened to by their wife anymore. You know, we found some pottery today. It was rather wonderful. Yes, dear, here's your soup. Right? Yes. So if you wander onto a dig and say, hey, what are you finding? And you seem to have a bit of background knowledge, they become animated and they want to share things. So in 2006, Pearson showed me around the dig that they were doing, and I remembered about 80% of what he said. So I started incorporating that in my tours before anything came out in publication. So the people on my tours were getting the very latest information about the Stonehenge builders and where they lived and the kind of lifestyle they had, and also how Stonehenge fits ritualistically within its landscape in a broader way. And some of the people on my tours are going, this isn't right, the books don't say this, he's got it all wrong. And then in 2013 or toward 2011, the book was published, you know, and then all of a sudden, then it's people go, oh, he was right after all. So because I go to conferences and kind of talk to people that are doing things, some of the narratives that I tell people actually surprise people, you know. So I know people who have been kind of going to Avebury for years, and when I point out some of these new ideas, they go, whoa, I have to change what you thought Avebury was, even the dating and the timing of it. So we now believe that Avebury is far, far older than the official carbon date. So if you get a book on Avebury, say if you get Mike Pitt's book on Avebury, Henge World, the carbon date in of Avebury in that book has been now shown to be incorrect.
Yeah, so it's constantly...
It's an unfolding, updating story.
Which you're obviously at the epicentre of.
Well, in a way, yeah, living here.
Living here, literally. I mean, your house is situated on some very, very powerful ley lines.
Yeah, you're sitting on it.
I'm sitting on. No wonder I'm feeling so relaxed here. There's a beautiful sunlight coming in, and I mean the energy here feels very, very clear. I mean, I know not everyone feels things kinesthetically, but it really is a It's a wonderful
space. It is indeed. And there's a very strong line going from Avery to Stonehenge.
Yes.
So if you get a ruler, and you a 20-mile long ruler, and you put the tip of it in Avebury, and then have it go through West Kennet Longbarrow, it will go through the centre of Stonehenge, then it will continue on for about another 10 miles and go through a place called Old Sarum, which is the original settlement outside Salisbury. It will go through an Iron Age hill fort on the other side of the valley called Clearbury Ring, and it will go right down to a place called Hengistbury Head, and then go into the sea. And so the ley line, kind of the sacred landscape tour that I run, follows that line. And so people, we kind of walk and drive and walk and drive from monument to monument all day long, with lectures all along the way. And you get buzzy. So yes. It might seem like a long day, because we start at 10 in the morning and finish at, I don't know, it's 7 p.m. But because you're on this line, you get recharged, you know. And people say, you could do this in a village hall with slides and biscuits and a cup of tea, but you wouldn't get the feel of it.
You wouldn't get the feel. So yeah, it's in a way, scale. It's a bit like a pilgrimage.
It is, it? Yeah.
It's like a sacred walk. And, you know, if you think of all the electromagnetic energy, whether you can feel it or not, it's nevertheless, it's very recharging.
Indeed. Well, I don't know if you know, the stones at Avebury, there's the famous kind of 28 or 29 stones at Stonehenge that come from the Preseli Mountains in Wales.
Yes.
Their stone was their medium. So what we do with our intellect, with electricity and polymers, they were doing with stone, right? So all of this is their NASA, if you think of it like that. Right. Now, bluestone is magic to them, because if you get a lump of bluestone and you crack it in half, then immediately put it into water, it turns blue. And that would be...
if stone is
the only thing you have,
yes.
For a stone to do that, that would be revered in a big way. All the other stones in Stonehenge, all the big trilithons and things, and the stones at Avebury, come from the Marlborough Downs, about 8 miles on the other side of Silbury over there. And they're called Sarsen stone. Now, Sarsen is derived from the word Saracen. So in the Middle Ages, anything that wasn't Christian was considered Islamic. Right? And so hence Saracen stone or Sarsen stone. And it was a silicate-infused sandstone that was crushed underneath the ice at the end of the Ice Age. And it's infused with quartz or silica. So if you catch the stones, like I know you're going to Avebury later, and if you look at the stones on the side of a stone where the sunlight is touching it directly, and you move your head from side to side, a little bit, jiggle your head, you'll see it twinkle. Because they're infused with quartz. Now, we know that if you get quartz and you put pounds of pressure on the side of a quartz crystal, it will release an electrical charge. And these things are tons in weight. So they literally buzz. And the guards at Stonehenge say the same thing. One guard said, "This place is really unnatural." I said, "Why is that?"
Supernatural.
I said, "Why is that?" He said, the stones are warm at night, in the winter.
Yes.
Right. So they're not being warmed up by the sun.
Yeah.
It's an internal heat that's coming out. And there's a couple of stones where you can feel like hot spots with your hand. It's almost like they've got chakras. There's another one where if you stand underneath it, you can feel the heat radiate down on your head. And so you can stand there on a kind of a cold, blustery day and kind of warm up.
This is why I've been coming to the sacred landscape for many, many years, at least three or four times a year, coinciding with the equinoxes and solstices, because this is the power spot for me. This is where I get very charged up. I mean, I am into crystals as well, so feel it.
Yeah.
But just sitting against the stones, touching them, being there, you could say that there's an electromagnetic aura surrounding this that we with our human eyes can't normally
see. Stonehenge has been measured with electromagnetic energy kind of devices, and they found that there is a kind of like almost like a dome shape electromagnetic field around it.
Many, many thanks, David, for spending your time with us today. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Find what you've been talking about has been so illuminating for me. Really, really fascinating info. So for any of the listeners who are interested in finding out more about what you do, your Stonehenge and Avebury tours, going onto your website,
mm-hmm.
and getting in touch with you. How would they go about this?
They can look at stonehenge-starlighttours.com. Or if they want to get in touch another way, if they go to rowan-astrology.com, mm-hmm. Or even indeed David Charles Rowan on Facebook, you can connect and find me there. So,
wonderful.
Yeah.